Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Market's starting to get a little worried as bonds kick into high gear. More bad news on the coronavirus, and our guest today is Matt Smith from Clipper Data. All this and much more on episode number 650 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very good day to you. I hope everything is well in your area, around the country, around the world. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of this podcast, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged, where each and every week we get together, myself and John C. Dvorak, to talk about, well, I would say some of the lighter side of the news, but all related and primarily related to markets, investments, and economics. So that's a really cool show. We do that at 9 o'clock live, stream it with a chat room over on dhunplugged.com, or you can, of course, find any of these in your favorite podcast directory, whether it's iTunes, wherever it is. And again, thanks so much for all those great reviews you've been doing. That's really appreciated. So we have a great guest lined up today. We have Matt Smith from Clipper Data, and he is an expert in the area of oil and other energy products, particularly studying the flow data and making determinations on pricing and outlook for the oil complex. So we're going to get to him in a little while. But before that, we have a few things to talk about. I think I wanted to remind you, I mentioned this and I hinted at this in our last episode, but be on the lookout for the March portfolio review. And that is, I'm turning 55 in March. Okay, March 20th, I'll be 55. Double nickels, reaching that age where I think they're going to start sending me mail from AARP. And if they do, I'm going to block it and say we don't want this. But nonetheless, I thought as a good celebration for my birthday and a bit of a thank you for all the great years that we've been doing this podcast, I would open up our portfolio review that we really do primarily just for clients for specific circumstances. But we'd open that up for free to all my listeners. So the official announcement is going to be coming out next week with all the details about how to upload your portfolios and your statements so that we can then take a look at them and find out more about what your asset allocation, sector allocation, where you're heavy, where you're light, give you some ideas about how to diversify your portfolio that would be well in line with your risk and time horizon. So it's a pretty cool review that we do. So make sure to listen to next episode, because that's going to be next week is the end of February already. Here we are at the end of February already. But next week's the end of February, and we'll announce it because starting March 1st, we'll have this available for you. So just stay tuned for that. Now, what's going on here in the news around the world and things that impact markets? Well, this week, pretty much, I would say most of it, yeah, there was some political, the Democratic debate, and there was a few other things with economic numbers came out. We had some central bank speakers. We had a couple companies, several companies posting earnings. But I think pretty much the news revolved around the coronavirus updates. It was pretty much a consumption of the news. And it's interesting because if you watch some of the news channels, and you know which ones I'm talking about, that are really focused in on politics, particularly in this election season that we're in right now. What's really interesting to note has been that even those stations that pretty much block off everything that's going on except for either praise or hatred for the president and for Congress and for what's going on, they even took a break and started to report on what's happening around the world, giving updates on the coronavirus, the outbreak, what to look for, what's happening. And I think that was kind of interesting because it's starting to really focus in on the infection rate and the growth of the infection rate, how much daily we're seeing an up or a down, how many deaths, the situation in China, the rest of the world. So each day we get this count, right? We get this number that comes out of China. Now, some may say, how do we believe them? We just can take the numbers that they provide at this point and utilize that to try to understand how this thing is either spreading or calming down. That's the only thing we can go with. I mean, there's nothing else. So we have to use this. And whether or not it's accurate, whether it's not, it's underreporting or accurately reporting, whatever you want to call it. The fact is that we're seeing that, yeah, last week there was some better numbers that came out of China. Then on Thursday, we saw a ramp up into Friday of more cases, in particular, some in, there was an outbreak at a prison, a few outside, further lockdowns on cities or provinces outside of Wuhan and where the area was that originally started, where they have 50 million people locked down. We're starting to see that that lockdown is spreading to other areas because it looks like from every piece of information that you can put together on this, if you step back and look at this and find out, okay, what's really happening? What are they really saying with all this information? I think it becomes very, very clear to anybody that is open to the reality that this is a problem. We've talked about that over the last few weeks, that this problem is not only centered around the idea that we have this infection rate and unfortunate deaths from this terrible flu or virus, but it isn't contained. And part of that is due to the fact that China didn't do a really good job at providing information for their citizens until many weeks after this erupted. And because they have a significant amount of clampdown on the media, and they control it, many of the reporting citizens that were involved with the concern in the beginning were shut down, thereby not allowing for the transmission of information so that people could protect themselves accordingly right off the bat. So they were late to that, and what that meant was because of the way that this transmits, the disease or the virus transmit from person to person, it allowed for a much wider range of infections to occur. But one of the things that is really interesting right now is that we're seeing some things like in Japan, the infection rate grow. A lot of them originally were on that one cruise ship that they started to let people off of. But worse than that, and I think the troubling fact right now is we're seeing surges in South Korea, Japan. In Iran, there was also a variant of this COVID-19 virus, and that's a problem because now this is suggesting that the epidemic is becoming, dare I say, a pandemic. And this is according to a lot of experts saying that, you know, we're seeing it in all these countries around the world, and some of them lighter than others, but we're starting to see a real surge in the neighboring countries or the countries that are closest to China, where many Chinese citizens may have actually gone for vacation or travel during the lunar holiday, the new year. So when you look at that and you add to that the news out about Apple and other companies that are seeing very significant slowdown in their supply chain due to the fact that manufacturing is pretty much shut down in China. And now you start to see that branching out. And the concern from people not willing to potentially go to work, not able to go to work because the company's closed down. And you have a real problem. And finally, we're starting to see a wake-up call from markets saying that, hey, you know what? Maybe even though it's over there, you know what? We're pretty much connected from an economic standpoint. While we may not see a significant amount of cases here in the U.S., the fact is that the connectiveness of our economies is so great that this virus may spread into the economic health of the world. We don't know how long this is going to last, because we're seeing, again, some better numbers out of China for a few days. Then it gets worse. Then we're seeing that more cases, I think we have 12 in the U.S. right now, or 12 that were identified in the U.S. And we're seeing that, again, Japan is spiking, South Korea, and Iran. We're starting to see outlier places getting some of this. And that will really play on the psychology of the consumer. And it's not just about the number of people that have the illness. No, that's not the point. It's the fear. It's the psychology of getting the virus and worrying about that. And then thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to stay inside. I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to travel. I'm not going to do what I usually did. I'm going to stay away from people. I'm not going to go to that restaurant. I don't know who's sick, because they may not be showing. There's the other problem. They don't necessarily have to show the, you know, a fever or a cold or a flu symptoms in order to transmit this deal. So you could be talking to somebody that seems apparently 100% healthy, and you're talking with them and you're doing things, and they're actually spreading that virus to you unknowingly. That is a problem from a psychological standpoint for people who are not willing to be out there, not willing to go to a restaurant, even a fast food, even a takeout. We're seeing some crazy measures, like McDonald's and Starbucks are doing contactless delivery. So you may have someone prepare the foods with all sorts of gloves on and all that, put it into a bag in a special area. Once it's picked up by somebody, they then scrub down the area. And I mean, can you imagine the impact on businesses having to go through a process like a McDonald's or any other fast food or any other quick food or takeout, whatever it is, to go through that process of trying to keep a contactless process going on? I mean, it seems crazy. But if they don't do that, what's the alternative, right? The alternative is they just shut down. So this fear and this psychology of getting the virus is going to have probably its greatest impact on economies. And over the past couple of weeks, we discussed this virtual stoppage of the economic activity in China. And now that's possibly starting to spread a little bit. And if it does spread into other countries, not only will there be a wider range of problems for Asia, but that economic wave of destruction is probably going to be felt as far as, what's the farthest point from Asia? I don't know. You know, somewhere in middle areas of Canada and United States. So this is that wake-up call. And what markets are finally waking up to is this reality. And we're seeing this with supply chains already. We're seeing commodity prices dip. Overall economic activity with a negative 6% annualized print of Japan's GDP last week. The concern that we may see a very significant dip in GDP, very significant. I mean, I can't put that strongly enough, but a massive write down on GDP in China. And you're seeing it in the bond markets and currency levels. I mean, just look where, for example, the U.S. Treasury yields have gone. On Friday, we closed the 10-year at 1.46%. And the 30-year, amazing. The 30-year closed sub 2% at 1.9%. If you just think about what the markets are doing, they seem to be doing okay this year, but the bond market, the long bond ETF, symbol TLT, is up more than 9% this year. That's amazing. This is after a 22% run over the last 1 year. So I got to be honest, I'm really comfortable with our reduced exposure for our clients' portfolios within the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, and also the reduced exposure, but a value slant in the global allocations and in investology. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with what I am seeing out there being a little bit lighter in equities right now. So you know where I stand on that. You know where I'm thinking things are right now and the impact we are going to see. And hopefully this doesn't sound like the boy that cried wolf or any other concern. I mean, we really haven't had this much concern except for the fact of the valuation bubble that we're seeing in a lot of equity areas due to the fact that the central banks have been so hard and pressuring up the valuations due to, well, liquefying the markets and cutting down interest rates. But what do you think? What do you think is going on? I'd love to hear from you. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and just tell me what your thoughts are on this whole coronavirus thing. I'd love to get some of your opinion, your thoughts on this. So we have, we can talk about this next week, what your thoughts are. Ask Andrew over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So now with that in mind, what I thought we would do is have someone on the show, an expert in the area of energy commodities, particularly related to crude and flows and oil and this whole area that really is an area that is showing through as something that I think is a good benchmark for global growth. So let's get Matt online and let's see what he has to say. And our guest today is Matt Smith of Clipper Data, and he's the Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, and he specializes in extracting key themes from technical and fundamental analysis of the global energy market and then communicating those through daily and weekly deliverables or like newsletters and information and research reports. Matt, how are you?
I'm very well, Andrew. Nice to speak to you.
Hey, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. I do follow your work, and I think that you have a great feel for the pulse of what's happening in the energy market. And that's what we're going to focus in on today. So let me just set the stage a little bit here in terms of how I see it. I'm not at all, at the level you are in this, but when it comes to oil, when you look at Brent or you look at WTI, oil, the big picture of oil, crude, a lot of things that really impact that. It's not only just simply, well, I guess we could just break it down to supply and demand, but there's a lot of other things that go on. So there's some things happening around the world that I wanted to explore with you, the situation in Libya, OPEC, et cetera. So let's start with Libya, what's going on there, and how is that really kind of impacting the global supply, and is this ever going to be resolved?
Yeah, sure, Andrew. That's a really interesting place to start because the headlines at the moment, are all about the coronavirus. But what's happening in the oil market is really as much as interesting what is happening with Libya as opposed to anywhere else, because we're seeing nigh on 1 million barrels a day of oil production offline. Essentially, what has happened is you have these kind of two warring factions, and one, the LNA, they control all the key ports in the east of the country and the oil fields, and they've essentially set up blockades since mid-January because they want to negotiate basically a distribution of the oil revenues. So they basically get some of that. And so that's basically just, cut that production. Mm-hmm. What's particularly interesting about Libya, more than perhaps any other country in the world, is that when you see their production drop, because they export the vast majority of it, you see it reflected straight through into their exports. And that has pretty much, that kind of immediate effect on the market. And so that's what has happened in the last month, where you've seen nearly 1 million barrels a day of oil taken off the market, not being put onto a ship and sent across the world. And yet there hasn't really been too much of a price impact because of everything else that has been happening with the coronavirus.
So, I mean, it was safe to say that if the coronavirus and the drop in demand, particularly from China, wasn't happening, that we would have possibly a much stronger price because of particularly what's happening in Libya.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and they export the sour, the Brent? What do they have?
They have a light sweet crude. So it's sweet. Actually, yeah, it's very similar to US shale crude. And so their predominant market is into Europe, so they send sort of 3/4 of their barrels there. And so what you've seen actually, it seemed like this would be a good opportunity for the US to kind of move in there and send some barrels across to Europe. But we haven't really seen that play out in the flows. We've actually seen Europe pulling in more sort of West African crude, some from Northwest Europe as well, those Brent barrels, as you mentioned there. But then it's also a bit of a lull in the market this time of year as well, as we're seeing a lot of refinery maintenance. So there's perhaps just not as much demand for it. So you're not necessarily seeing the US jumping in and filling that gap as you would perhaps would see in, say, the peak of the summer or something like that. All that said, it may come through in the coming weeks. We're just not seeing it yet in the flows.
You know, I never asked this question, and I think you may know this answer. So the difference between the types of oil that are out there, you mentioned light sweet, and we talked about sour. What's the difference? Like, how is one originated? Is it fatter or uglier or bigger or smaller dinosaurs? Or what was it? What makes the difference?
No, it totally does, yeah. So we actually track 400 different grades of crude. There's all different types. It's probably a bad comparison to say it's like wine or something like that, or beer, but it really kind of is in those variations. And actually, Libya crude is a great example because they call that the champagne of crude.
Oh.
Because it's such high quality. So when a crude is described as light, it's basically that's based on the APIs and how light or as heavy it is. So the lighter it is, the higher quality. And then the sweet and sour, the lower sulfur it has, the more sweet it is.
So then what's the PIMS? For those of you that don't know, you know what PIMS is, of course.
What's the PIMS? Oh my gosh.
By the way, just for those folks that don't know what this PIMS is a very, very popular drink in the UK.
A PIMS is probably like a posh US crude would be a PIMS, I think.
And then what would be the Marmite?
Oh my gosh. The Marmite would be a Venezuelan crude, the real kind of nasty, gunky stuff.
Yeah.
The very low quality. Yeah. I love Marmite.
You have to love Marmite. And how do you eat it? Do you eat it on a cracker?
I have it on bread with butter because the butter, the saltiness of the butter and the Marmite is a great combination.
Yeah, and just to let everybody know, if you haven't, you've probably heard me talk about this before. There's two different versions of this kind of same item. There's Marmite, which is UK, and they love it there, and there's Vegemite, which is Australian. And this is, as I would say, it tastes the equivalent of salted tar.
I'm not sure that's quite fair.
Oh.
It's a bit better than that.
Right.
But it is true that basically their marketing campaign has always been you either love it or you hate it.
Yep.
And it sounds like I love it, and Andrew, you don't.
Yeah, I don't care for it too much. I mean, maybe I have to have it again, but who knows? So this Libyan outage, and I think it's fascinating because all the regions around the world, they seem to have their own little bits of kind of areas of fighting that happens, or it always also seems to be an interesting time when this happens, when there's a lot of or reduced demand, and all of a sudden there's a flare-up somewhere. You know, you get the situation in Libya, and, you know, if it really gets bad, God forbid, you know, all of a sudden there's really not a lot of need. What are you going to get? Well, you're going to get somebody bombing a pipeline in Nigeria.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what's happened, though, in the last couple of years. We've been in such a situation of oversupply, and we've seen that because OPEC have tried to, you know, cut production to balance the market. But we've essentially had this buffer from the US because US shale has been increasing over the last couple of years, that as you've had these outages, say in Nigeria, the pipeline explosion, or with Libya or in the Middle East or that, you haven't seen the price response as perhaps you would have seen 5-10 years ago.
And I'm of the notion, this is kind of going out far afield here, but I'm of the notion that the reason why we saw the oil move up over the last year, I think it would get to $60 or so, let's call it 60-ish.
Yeah.
Really wrapped around the whole Saudi Aramco IPO, the necessity of bringing up prices so they can price out their IPO at the right price, which has since fallen dramatically, of course. But do you think that was aligned to that whole situation where OPEC was really regulating, cutting back production, and Saudi Arabia in particular, because they wanted to make sure they had the right price on that IPO?
I think they were, and I think they still are, from the perspective that Saudi needs a price of around $80 a barrel on that Brent basis for them to meet their budgetary needs. All of these, or the vast majority of OPEC members, need a higher price than where we are now. And so they're incentivized to cut production. That said, a lot of them don't actually do it. You know, it's a lot of finger pointing and expecting others to do it. But to your point with Saudi, they were so keen last year to get that price up, and they still are. They are the ones that are doing the heavy lifting, the lion's share of cutting production. And from, you know, from my lens of looking at the exports, we've seen that play out versus previous years, and they are being very much restrained in how much they're exporting to try and lift that price higher.
I mean, right now we're seeing the jawboning that's going on from OPEC, right? Because as soon as we got this whole discussion about, well, China doesn't, well, the problems with getting anything into China and the problems with the demand in China when the country is basically shut down for business and spreading out throughout Asia the same problems. And all of a sudden, we have OPEC starting to talk about, well, we may start thinking about a cut, right? You know, this whole thing,
right.
That jawboning helps to bring up the markets. Do the markets ever figure out it's just jawboning, or they don't care?
Well, it has a little bit of a sentiment impact, you know, when these headlines do hit the wires. But it's to be expected when we see crude prices drop down into the 50s, you know that they're going to want to intervene in some kind of way. So they first try with the jawboning, and then if that doesn't work, then they look at other measures like having a meeting, you know,
Meeting, the threat of a meeting.
Well, that's coming up early next month.
Of course.
And, you know, I think that we have seen some success from Saudi in terms of supporting prices, particularly in 2017. They were very smart about cutting flows to the U.S. They cut, and by doing that, they really helped lower U.S. inventories. And so they do have the ability to impact the market and the oil price. It's just they have all these other members which they have to try and cajole into doing something as well, who just really don't pull their weight.
Yeah, well, they're sitting fat and happy for the most part until things get really bad. But when you talk about the Saudi oil being cut and then cutting on inventories in the U.S., how much truth is there to the fact that the U.S. is now energy independent, or maybe even to a point we're a net exporter of oil right now? And then the tack on to that is, doesn't that mean that the potential for higher oil prices is not as impactful on our economy as it once was, where it was a drag and now could actually be a benefit?
There's a lot in that question there. But in terms of us being energy independent, that isn't the case from the perspective that we're still on any given day importing, you know, 6.5-7 million barrels into the U.S. You know, a good chunk of that is coming from Canada, admittedly, and even more so, like nearly 4 million barrels a day. So we're less reliant on the Middle East, we're less reliant on Latin America. And so, but at the same time as well, we are still having to pull that in. The U.S. consumes about 20 million barrels a day. Production is about 13. So that's that difference there. But from being a net importer to a net exporter of crude and products, which the U.S. has done now, and that will continue to be the way, is something that is, puts the U.S. on a much stronger footing, because they don't have to rely on others, and they are essentially being able to set the price of crude more because they are more influential.
So what do you see from a technical standpoint? When I say technical, I mean, do you use charting also, aside from just the necessary requirements to look at supply-demand fundamentals, right?
Yeah, so we are really focused on the flows. And so we're looking at the flows to figure out what it's going to do to price, and then vice versa as well. So we do look at a technical analysis, but we're not focused on pricing as much as we are on what does this mean for the people that are buying our data or buying our analysis.
Right. So we bounced off that 49-ish level in WTI recently after everybody was freaking out for a few days about the coronavirus. And then all of a sudden that lasts, you know, everything lasts like less than a day now, right? You know, we had the Iranian, I called it a 23-hour war in Iran. You know, we have all this, and then everybody's like, get back to business. And we have, the crude market dipped down to 49, I think it's 49.20 or something, right around the 49-ish area, back up to 55, 56 coming in. Where is your outlook, which is probably a very hard thing to do right now, with all this happening. But what's your outlook for throughout the rest of this year for crude?
It depends.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. I know, so it's hard because you don't know how much of this coronavirus is going to spread, how much of a right. shutdown to the economy. I get it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You did see the demand then for the coronavirus get priced in very quickly into crude prices. That's why we got down to that $49 level there. And so as we're seeing, you know, gradual signs of a peaking in the virus, we're seeing a bit more confidence coming back into prices. That said, the demand dent cannot be understated, how that is impacting products from like a gasoline and middle distillate perspective, and that's going to play out for a number of months here, and as well as in the economic indicators. So yes, we've seen the bounce in oil prices now, but do I think that we're going to push on into the 60s and perhaps above that? That seems unrealistic, given the soft economic data that's coming through and the soft impact that the coronavirus is going to have on a ripple effect. And so I think, as you mentioned, you get this buying in, selling interest come in. We got pushed down to that 49 level. It went there very quickly, but a lot of people were focused on that level, and now that feels somewhat like a floor because you do get that much buying interest coming in there. Whereas if we break above 60, 65, you know, $70, look at 65 on WTI, the US benchmark, but the Brent benchmark is that much higher. Once that gets up above that kind of $70 level, then that feels like a ceiling because you have demand concerns coming in. So I think we're going to stay in the lower half of that that band there between, you know, sort of 50 to 70 for WTI going forward.
And this is demand destruction, because even if we snap our fingers today and everything goes back to totally normal, that block of time that
right.
people weren't driving, people weren't utilizing whatever particular use for their oil, that's not reappearing. It's not like people need to go out and double up and buy. It's kind of like the service industry, right? So people aren't going out to eat because right. they're locked down in their community. It's not like they're going to be like, we're going to triple up and quadruple up on our eating out.
Yeah. And it feels like the market as well is looking at this and being, well, you know, it could have a V-shaped recovery here, but for the reasons you've just stated, we shouldn't necessarily see that at all.
Yeah. So let's talk about a totally different item, and let's get into this idea of IMO 2020, which is revolving around the whole shipping industry. And how does yep. that going to impact things? And first of all, let's back up. Can you please explain what IMO 2020 is?
Yeah, sure. So for like the last year or two, it's been the biggest thing that will be coming to the market for years and years. So IMO 2020, and essentially what it is this body, the International Maritime Organization, who put a ruling in place that said the amount of sulfur being burned on vessels in their fuel had to be reduced from 3.5% to 0.5%. And so doing that on a global basis is like to 60,000, 70,000 vessels, something like that. And so it was going to have a huge impact, because what these guys are burning at the moment, they're using the gunkiest stuff, the high sulfur fuel oil. It's cheap, it's nasty, and they've all had to go, and they've had the option really of choosing one of two things. One is LSFO, which is low sulfur fuel oil, or marine gas oil, which is basically diesel, like what trucks run on.
The point is, it's more expensive.
Yeah, both of those are more expensive. And so there was this expectation, as you'd see perhaps a drop of 2 million barrels a day of HSFO out of the market, that would be replaced by this much higher diesel. So suddenly there'd be this flip of a switch on January 1st of this year, and there would be this sudden incremental demand for diesel of 2 million barrels a day. And then that expectation came down to 1.5, and then it came down further. But what we've seen has been much more of an uptake of LSFO, the low sulfur fuel oil. And essentially what that is it's taking the high sulfur stuff and then mixing it with the diesel and then to get at that lower blend, to get that lower sulfur. But because that has happened, there's been a greater uptake of that than expected. It hasn't had as much of an impact. At the same time as well, you know, we've had a softer economic backdrop, and now we've got the coronavirus issue too. So this was expected to be a real market shaking, crazy event. And that just didn't happen.
But what do happen is, no matter how you look at it, it's a much more expensive proposition for the shippers. And, you know, some of these, if they don't use that or they use the combination, they're also using these scrubbers, right? And they're trying to kind of intermediate the flow, take out the sulfur. I don't know where it goes from there, by the way, but it goes probably just in the air anyway. But they take out this, I guess the scrubbers take it out, and then it doesn't get into the engine flow, and therefore it's not extruded from the final product when it's burnt.
They're scrubbing it. The scrubbers scrub it on the way out.
Oh, they scrub it on the way out. So where does it end up?
It's in the, it gets then put into to what is kind of a, it's on a loop system, they call it, and it gets looped back in. It stays in water in the vessel, and then they have to get rid of that water, not into the ocean, but they get, they have to discharge that at a place where it gets dealt with.
And this and, is, but again, all of this is cost factors.
Right. So a scrubber costs you like, I think it's something like $3 to $8 million to put in place on your vessel. And then the expectation is that you, you have this huge outlay, and then you make that money up because you continue to buy the really cheap, gunky fuel rather than having to buy the more expensive stuff, which is less of a pollutant.
And this comes at a time that we're seeing that demand is, forget coronavirus, demand is dropping anyway. Aside from coronavirus, right? We're seeing the Baltic Dry Index, which is not necessarily the same ships you're working with here, but the Baltic Dry Index falling off a cliff.
Yeah.
Prices for, you know, and not only that, cargo ships, for example, down in the 20% range of capacity with cargo right now, losing money on that. I mean, this is a real problem for the shippers. Although last week, you know, and all, right?
Yeah. Well, we track container ships as well. And so we've seen just in the last month or that, the scheduled port calls are dropping off, and they're going to continue to drop off as well. So you're really seeing this showing up in some of the data, even tracking iron ore, that is, you know, like a Baltic Dry Index type thing. We're seeing flows of that into China really dropping off. And so I think some people are somewhat misled. If you look at the crude flows, and you still see them strong going in towards East Asia, people think, oh, you know, everything is okay. Maybe these guys are just bargain hunting here. But really, the supply side may be continuing, but the demand side is really crippled, it seems.
So let's switch over for a second. You cover natural gas and LNG?
Yes, we do a bit of LNG tracking. We do a lot of LNG tracking, yes.
So what's happening? I mean, first of all, explain what that is. But yeah. natural gas prices are just bad. I mean, is there any other way to describe it?
No. And so what we've seen, it's been this kind of perfect storm of things, really, from the perspective that, so the US producers have continued to push out more natural gas. A lot of that has been a byproduct of oil production. So as you see, you know, US oil production increase 1 million barrels a day last year. There's a lot more natural gas being produced via, it's called associated gas. And so these guys are going after the oil, the gas comes out, and so they're just, you know, it doesn't matter to them how much they get for that. As long as it's over zero, it's a profit. LNG is essentially, it's liquefied natural gas. You freeze it, I think it's like minus 250 degrees Celsius, something like that. It's, you know, 600 times more dense as a liquid than as a gas, and so you're able to then export it. And so that's what the US has shifted to be, is this exporter of natural gas, of this LNG. But we've seen slowing on an economic
Well, I think China was China was the whole, they started building, finally, they built a couple of, what do you call it, docks, marinas. They built these places to hold these and to create, you know, put them on. But I think China was the number one buyer of this stuff, right?
It's one of them. So half of the LNG market is made up by Asia. So you have China, South Korea, and then Japan. But Japan is dropping off a little bit. But yeah, China has been really on the rise. But the thing is as well, they had a really cold winter a couple of years ago, and they got caught short. And so they've made sure that they always have a good amount of supply. And then this winter, it's been very mild in Asia. It's been very mild in Europe and in the US here as well. And so that means that they haven't had as much need from a demand perspective, heating demand. And so you've seen US prices drop below $2 an MMBTU here, but then you're seeing it cratering all over the globe as well.
So just to finish up on this LNG and oil supply-demand equation and the idea of it. Are you tracking at all the impact of a change in vehicle design in terms of utilizing electric cars and how that is changing the demand? Because, I mean, I think oil, I mean, that's the big one, right? Is cars.
Yeah. So in the U.S., I think you're starting to see the tremors of that coming through. So U.S. product supply, that proxy for fuel demand, is pretty much flat. We're not seeing it grow. There is a big increase in electric vehicles, but it's from a very small base. And so, yes, they're on the rise, but they're starting from a very small base. And I think that you will see that continuing to tick higher and start to make a bigger and bigger dent in gasoline demand, but it's going to take its time. But what's really going to drive it is going to be the economics, where you reach that tipping point where the technology is in place and the economics are in place, where it makes more sense for someone to buy an electric vehicle rather than a Camry or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And once we reach that point, that's going to be peak gasoline demand. And it seems as if that's going to happen before the end of this decade.
Hmm. So just to finish up, I don't know if this is something that you actually you project, but do you have like, hey, we're bullish on oil right now, we're bearish, we're neutral on natural gas. Do you have those kind of things, or you just put out facts?
We just put out more of the flows rather than anything. I think we're fairly neutral as a house view on crude at the moment, just simply because we're so concerned about the demand side of the picture and the products and what we're seeing, the lack of
inactivity. And you're seeing that, by the way.
The lack of activity.
Just to tie this into everything we've been talking about over the last several weeks, that I said time and time again that, hey, this coronavirus thing, it's not over yet. Whether or not the coronavirus itself is slowing down or not, whether it's spreading to other countries, death rate and mortality rates, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the ripple of shutting down China, essentially, for a matter of even a month. I mean, that you're seeing that, right?
Well, yeah, we're seeing it in the data. You're seeing it just starting to hit the broader market here as well, with like Apple. You're starting to hear about it in the supply chains across the various different industries. But from the specific data, you know, we've seen their refinery runs coming off like nearly 3 million barrels a day down to 11 million barrels a day. So they've really had to dial back there. We've seen their crude inventories build by about 60 million barrels. We're seeing a buildup of crude off of China there. We're seeing more going into other countries in the region simply because some of these vessels are being diverted. And so there's all manner of different indicators in the flows data that's showing up these impacts. They're going to be impacting the broader markets over the coming weeks and months.
Great. Well, Matt Smith, you did a great job. I want to let you know that such a great job that I am awarding you a double pudding this evening.
Yes.
Okay.
And could I have a slice of toast with some Marmite?
Absolutely.
As well?
Tell us how people can get information on you, where to go. We're going to put it also on the show notes for episode number 650 for thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But where do people go to find out more information about what you're doing?
Sure. Well, it's www.clipperdata.com.
Okay. And what about your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is MattVSmith01. The V is for Vincent, MattVSmith01.
Oh, and the 01 is because you're the first one? Or just Matt V? There's another Matt V. Smith, I guess.
I'm not quite sure why I did that.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
All right, great. That was some great information on crude. I mean, talk about a real interesting look into what's happening with the flow of crude around the world and how the impact of some of the things that happened on the economics due to a variety of factors, just a general slowdown, and now this other wild card that's thrown in regarding the coronavirus is really starting to really flow through into this area. So I think there is something there. It's kind of a tell, a wink, a nod to the fact that there is something happening that we need to be aware of. So pretty cool stuff. We're going to end it there this week. I thank you so much for joining me, and I'm going to see you again next week. Have a great week. I'll see you soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.